Welcome to the Back in Time tour of Ohio's Route 33 between Athens and Lancaster. As you travel the route, we're going to tell you about the history of the area you're traveling through. The map indicates where along the road is the best place to listen to each track, and it and our website have links to other cultural attractions in the area. We encourage you to stop in the towns along the way and, if you have time, to travel the older portions of Route 33 to enjoy life in the slow lane. I'm Sandra Slight-Brennan, the producer and narrator, but you won't hear too much from me. Mainly, you'll be listening to people who grew up in the region and to historians and geographers who have studied its history.
Well, it was curvy, very curvy. And if you went to from here to Columbus, that's about an all-day trip up and back.
I can remember driving to Columbus on Route 33, and there wouldn't be one single tree along the Hocking River.
As you drive along old Route 33 here, if you look back into the woods, you can see little openings to old mines. They were old punch hole mines where they didn't go in very far, but they worked their way in with picks and axes.
The only road through here went to Nelsonville, Logan. There was no bypass until 57, so when the university let out, there was times that, you know, you couldn't get across the road. There were so many cars.
If you look at your map of the region, you'll see lots of names of towns that, when you look for them, you can't seem to find. Many of these were company towns from the once booming coal, clay, brick, and iron ore industries. You can find towns like New Floodwood, Jobs, Orbison, and Diamond. Once these communities had hundreds of houses, but today, many of them barely exist. Some have well-worn homes left, and others, like Diamond, are only a memory. I talked with a few people who remembered what living in those company towns was like.
They had some three-room houses. This is a four-room. They had some three-room houses. In fact, when we moved here, we moved in a three-room house.
The mining camp was laid out in rows, just like streets. In the what we called the lower end of the camp, they called it Hunky Town, because there were mostly foreigners.
Oliver Riley and Sid Cosma both grew up in coal mining towns. Oliver in Sugar Creek, a few miles down the road from Athens, and Sig lived over the hill in the town of Millfield.
We had three or four company stores, and that's where the miners went to get their commodities or food and kerosene for their lamps.
Company towns, wherever they were, had many similar characteristics. Sadie Parks grew up in Millfield, where her father and later her husband were coal miners.
It was hell. There was no restraint. I can't tell you all the particulars, but I can tell you that it was tough. They would have cockfights. They would have, all kinds of gambling, and they would have all this drinking. And the men thought that that was what made them tough, you know, because they were coal miners, and they, you know, worked in the coal mine.
Many of these towns started as mining camps. Single men, says historian Laura Lee Porter, often stayed in dormitories.
And three shifts of men sleeping in the same bed. Maybe 40 guys in a dormitory.
Some of them, a lot of them lived in Millfield and all around this area, for miles around here. Jacksonville, Gloucester, Trimble, and Chancy, Doaneville, and Mineral, and all these places around here. They would come there to work, and they would rent a room or a house or a shanty or whatever they could find to live in. And they lived there. And then on the weekends, if they had a train that went to where they lived, their hometown, on the weekends they would go home, come back on Sunday night.
But not all miners could go home on the weekend. By the early 1900s, more and more miners came here as immigrants. By 1905, 1 million immigrants a year were coming to America. Some of those came to the coalfields of Ohio. Many of these new immigrants were from Eastern Europe. When it became clear that war would soon break out in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, women started to arrive as well. Laura Lee Porter has studied and written about this immigration in her book, The Immigrant Cocoon.
Many of these women came as mail-order brides from the same little village back home. But she'd get off the boat, she'd take the train, she'd meet the man she was going to marry, the priest or the minister would be there and marry her. Frequently the bride had four or five boarders to feed that night.
There were Hungarians, Slovaks, we had one Chinese and had one Russian family, and about two Italian families, and then there were several Polish and Czechoslovakia. They were a varied group of people lived in that end of town.
Evil and strong.
And that was in the early immigration. Now, there was Hungarians, and there was all kinds of, different nationalities, you know. And most of them were nice people, you know, I mean hard workers, you know. And that's what they come here for, was a good job, but they didn't get one.
You always had a garden. You always had chickens. You always had pigs. You lived always with the fear the mines would shut down, and you had to have some savings here. You had to have something to fall back on.
Hard work. You know that back in those days, kids didn't have time to play. They had to work. If we ate, we had to work. If you talk about the good old days, well, honey, I don't want to go back to them. No way.
But these hardships also broke down the barriers of language and culture. People in the community helped each other out, and the coal town became not a collection of people from other places, but a community.
Because essentially, everybody became neighbors. Everybody knew everybody's name, their business, who was sick and who wasn't, and how much help you could give those who needed help, and they took care of one another.
They left a heritage of frugality, extremely hard work, absolute responsibility, but also a real peasant distrust of the elite and of outsiders. And that merges with a kind of an Appalachian distrust with outsiders, and you can see that too.
Notice that much of Route 33 follows the Hocking River. The river starts in Fairfield County's Bloom Township and flows into the Ohio at Hockingport in Athens County. Its name came from a Wyandot name, Hohokan, or Hohochen, which meant gourd shape, and refers to the river's shape near the present-day town of Logan. It was called the Hocking River until the late 1800s.
I think we have to start with the fact that rivers were the original mode of transportation. That's how people traveled, that's how people got goods to market.
Dr. David Mould of Ohio University has studied early transportation routes in the Hocking River Valley. He wrote about them in his book, Dividing Lines.
The Hocking River flowing into the Ohio River was the initial route of transportation. Now, that gave you only one option. You could ship down to the Ohio River, down to Cincinnati, and then ultimately to the New Orleans market, which meant that farmers in this region were very dependent on what was happening on that particular market. You know, if all your crops arrived at the same time, prices would go down. Very early on, it became apparent that people needed alternate routes, and that then led to the building of the canal.
The Ohio and Erie Canal came as far as Carroll, but that didn't help farmers and businessmen in the Hocking Valley. So, in 1826, Lancaster businessmen decided to invest their money and build a canal, the Lancaster Lateral, Ohio's first private canal venture. It connected with the Ohio and Erie Canal at Carroll. A few years later, in 1837, people in the Hocking Valley convinced the Ohio legislature to finance the Hocking Canal. It would run from Lancaster to Athens and would provide a way to get the mineral resources of the Hocking coal fields and salt mines to market. It was completed in 1843. Tom O'Grady is a local geography and history enthusiast. He has visited most of the canal remnants in the Hocking Valley.
It was 56 miles long, and I think there were about 26 locks, and I forget how many culverts, and a culvert is where the canal crossed a stream. And then there was one aqueduct, and that's where the canal crossed Monday Creek. A culvert is really an aqueduct, but the culvert is all stone. It's like a stone arch. It's all one piece of construction. An aqueduct typically had piers on either side of the river and a bridge sort of a thing that carried it, and it was a separate structure, oftentimes wood.
A few culverts still exist along Old Route 33. In Logan, at Old Town Creek, you can still see the logs that the culvert was built on in the 1830s. And at Haydenville, the culvert and a stone lock still exist. The stonework is amazing. It's hard to believe that they were built over 170 years ago. Sam Sloan of Logan explained how the massive stone blocks were cut.
And they would drill a hole in the rock, then they would take oak pegs and drive down in, then they'd pour water on top of them. Then the water would go into the pegs and expand, and that would break that off. Then they'd come back the next day and they'd all be broke loose. And that's how they got that stuff loose to bring it out.
It was estimated that the Hocking Canal would cost about $347,000 to build. It ended up cost